So welcome back, everyone. I'm going to give a short talk to try and introduce some of the aspects of this practice. And it's a tough thing to do in such a short retreat to decide what to talk about, would be most helpful for the people that are here. So I've kind of taken three talks. I couldn't decide between three, so there's pieces of three different kind of areas. But I think they fit together, and I think they give a good overview of different ways of coming at this practice, rather than just kind of seeing it as one thing. And I kind of see we can come toward our practice and our investigation and, you know, sort of what we do while we're doing this thing called meditation practice in a couple of different directions. So one direction is becoming aware of our triggers and our reactions, the story that we layer onto our direct experience. Just becoming aware of those habits of mind, how they arise, and thereby giving us opportunities to avoid falling into those holes of life. Being triggered, in other words. Because if we're aware, there's the chance that either the trigger won't occur, or that if it does occur, the recovery is much quicker. So that's one aspect that we talk about with this practice. And the other is, another direction that we take is this whole notion of cultivating wholesome qualities of mind. Joy, generosity, gratitude, and so forth. As the Buddha said in many different ways, that upon which we ponder becomes the inclination of the mind. So if you think a lot about joy and happiness and so forth, that will become over time the inclination of the mind. So I always like to balance those two aspects of the practice, bringing the joy into the practice, that aspect of the practice, as well as the awareness of the suffering in life and how, and the pitfalls and the reactions that we have. So I'll try to talk about both of those aspects. First, what is insight meditation? There's the handout, of course, and hopefully you've had a chance to read that, and if not, I encourage you to read it over and over and over again, really, just to get a sense of what it's saying. Each sentence there's so much there to understand. But insight meditation is our translation. It's not really a translation. It's meant to mean the same as Vipassana Bhavana. So we've taken Vipassana Bhavana. You've probably heard of Vipassana meditation. And it's actually the full phrase is Vipassana Bhavana. And we've translated that to insight meditation. Vipassana, so just to sort of dissect this, let's start with Bhavana, actually. Bhavana is from the root bu, which means to grow or to become. And it's always used in relation to the mind. So it's basically a mental cultivation, a mind training, becoming, you know, cultivating. So that's what the word bhavana is pointing to, is this mental cultivation. Vipassana is derived from two roots, pasana, which means seeing or perceiving, and vai, which means into or through. So it's a mental cultivation that helps us see or penetrate, perceive through or into something. And that something is the reality of our existence, the inner workings of reality. And we're seeing through it because we live in this, under this kind of veil or a cloud based on our conditioning. And those thoughts, the conditioned thoughts that interpret and comment on reality, we take that to be reality, as opposed to seeing into reality itself. So that's really what the practice is about, is to pierce the inner workings of reality itself. And I always like to read this, hopefully I got it, this quote by Einstein, pretty smart guy. And it's astonishing that he said this, and you may have heard this quote in relation to meditation before. A human being is part of the whole called by us universe, a part limited in time and space. He or she experiences him or herself, their thoughts and feelings, as something separated from the rest, a kind of optical delusion of consciousness. This delusion is a kind of prison for us, restricting us to our personal desires and to affection for a few persons nearest to us. Our task must be to free ourselves from this prison by widening our circle of compassion to embrace all living creatures in the whole of nature. Albert Einstein. So he's pointing there to this, what he calls an optical delusion of consciousness. So this is what we're, with this practice, is what we're seeing into. And of course, mindfulness is a key part of that. We're paying attention to what's happening in our direct experience, moment by moment. So that's the way of seeing reality, because reality is what's happening in the moment, not what we think about it. In fact, the thought is simply something that's happening in the moment that can be also observed. So it's this bare attention. And as I said last night, bare of what? It's bare of judgment and decision and identification with the commentary. So bare attention to what is occurring in our experience moment by moment, and bare of judgment, decision, and identification with commentary. So we've been mindful of breathing and as body sensations, and then mindful of what arises as we do that: thoughts, moods, emotions, body sensations. The whole enchilada, as they say. Everything is there to be observed, whatever it might be. And you might have found, too, that you can pay attention for a short amount of time, and then, whammo, you get sort of carried away by some thought train, which is fine. I mean, that's what's happening in the moment. It's not a bad thing. Hopefully I've made that point. It's not a problem. it's part of the practice. And in fact, what pulls our attention away, or what distracts us, what hooks us, is really interesting to notice. Because these are the things in our life that are probably causing us stress. Right? Because you're just, think about it, you're just going to sit here and I'm just going to be. And of course, your mind keeps hooking you away with these other things. What we might, distractions. So it's very interesting to see what is catching us, how we're getting caught, and what we can learn from that. Those places where we get caught are the places in our life where we're likely feeling stress. So we really get to know these hooks or these triggers. Really get to know what they are. And what you'll find is they'll start to lose their juice once they've been seen. In fact, if you go on a really long retreat, you just... I've had this experience, and I've had other people have the same similar. So they actually start laughing at it, you know, because it's absolutely quite absurd. After 7 days of this, is that all you got? I mean, it's the same old story, you know. And so it actually becomes laughable in some cases that this is the same old. You know, I started calling it the top 10 tunes. You know, this is like a broken record or something, right? It just keeps playing. And so not only did it lose its juice, it sort of became comical in a way, just to see it over and over again. I would like to read, I guess you could call it a poem. For me, this kind of summarizes the Vipassana Bhavana practice and our journey through it, from beginning to end. So if I could read one thing to you, this would be what I would choose, just in terms of, you know, especially for those starting out in the practice. Well, for anybody, because you can kind of see where you're at on this journey. So it's autobiography in 5 short chapters. Chapter 1. I walk down the street. There's a deep hole in the sidewalk. I fall in. I am lost. I am helpless. It takes forever to find a way out. Chapter 2. I walk down the same street. There's a deep hole in the sidewalk. I pretend I don't see it. I fall in again. I can't believe I'm in the same place. It takes a long time to get out. It still takes a long time to get out. Chapter 3. I walk down the same street. There's a deep hole in the sidewalk. I see it is there. I still fall in. It's a habit. My eyes are open. I know where I am. It's my fault. I get out immediately. Chapter 4. I walk down the same street. There's a deep hole in the sidewalk. I walk around it. Chapter 5. I walk down another street. So if you want to skip a few chapters and just so the holes in the sidewalk are you know, the difficulties in life, the suffering that is part of this human existence that we come across. It's unavoidable. One of the big teachings of the Buddha. And if that's all you understand from what the Buddha said, that part of life, part of this human existence involves suffering. I mean, it involves joy and happiness, but it also involves, there's also difficulties. Old, we age, we get sick, and so on and so forth. If you can just kind of realize that and be okay with that, that's a huge, I mean, if that's all you get out of this practice, that's life-changing. That's life-changing. If you don't even go beyond the first noble truth, there's 4 of them, just stick with the first one. It's life-changing. Because something can happen. Yeah, this is life. So that's what those holes in the sidewalk are. But we try to, you know, oh, this shouldn't be happening to me. Or, I mean, what did I do wrong to cause this to happen? And the mind gets, you know, the commentary about it, rather than this is suffering. This is what's happening. Okay, so. I'd like to talk about, just briefly, the attitudes of mindfulness. These are very helpful to bring to your practice. And I constantly come back to these attitudes of mindfulness in my practice. One is beginner's mind, and I mentioned that before. Coming to, you know, coined by Suzuki Roshi, a Zen teacher that came from Japan to the U.S. Many decades ago, and was one of the early pioneers in introducing the practices to the West. Coined this beginner's mind, it refers to seeing the present moment in a fresh and open way. And he would say, Suzuki Roshi would say, in the beginner's mind there are many possibilities, in the expert's mind there are few. So if you come to each moment with this kind of freshness, so many possibilities that can then come out of that. Because you're not going, well, I've been here before, and I don't know what's going to happen, and I'm just going to react this way, and that. So then habits just continue. Seeing it as a fresh, as every moment as unique and in a fresh way, opens up all kinds of possibilities. Yeah. The second one to mention is non-judging. Gives rise to a clear seeing awareness. Because judging is a filter to the present moment, and it colors everything we experience. It's that veil that we're trying to see through, in fact. So by not judging, we can discern the situations outside of our conditioning, our conditioned response that the mind judging. And the judging occurs due to the mind's search for happiness in objects of the world. So there's a constant dislike going on in our relationship to, I say, objects. It's sights, sounds, smells, tastes, and so on, the thoughts. The dislike, wanting more of something and wanting less of something else, and this constant struggle that we go through. It's the mind's desire to find happiness. We all want to, the Dalai Lama says, everybody just wants to be happy. It's really our kind of, if you think about it, it's kind of what motivates most of what you do. I mean, I don't know, maybe all of what we do. Happiness for ourselves and perhaps a circle of loved ones. So how do we find that happiness? That joy? I think happiness, the Dalai Lama talks about, there's a new book called, I don't know how new it is, I think it's new. It's new to me, so it's new. It's called the Book of Joy. It must be new because nobody nodded. It's usually you mention a book. It's actually the Dalai Lama and Desmond Tutu coming together recently, and their dialogues about joy. And they distinguish between happiness and joy, which I thought was interesting. Now, happiness is what we search for in the objects of the world. So this will make us happy. This new tea gizmo will definitely make me happy. I'll no longer spill tea while I'm giving talks. And there's a certain amount of functionality, and I do like it, but whether or not it'll bring ultimate happiness is probably questionable. But we think, well, happiness comes from our relationship to all these objects. I'd be happy if I had the right job. I'll be happy if I have the right salary, the right amount of money, the right relationship. If I could just find the perfect woman or man or whatever it might be, I'll be happy. And this goes on and on and on. And I think at some point it may dawn on us that after we've had, after numerous failed attempts at actually finding ultimate happiness in any one of these things, that this may not be the path to happiness. It dawned on, it took a long time. Maybe I'm a little slow because I'm 58, and it took me a while to dawn on me that I have the same partner, my wife. We've been married for 35 years, so I didn't sort of start searching out. But it occurred to me, oh, maybe I'd be happier if I ditched her and, you know, went off with this other, you know, that arises as the mind conjures up that. Luckily, I didn't believe it, and because it would have been a huge mistake. She's a beautiful person to be with. But that's the mind's grasping for happiness. And so the Dalai Lama and Desmond talk about joy as being something that's not found in objects in the world, but something it's an inner creation. So it's how we incline the mind. It's it's a state of produced through our inner resources. Nothing needed outside of our inner self. And I won't go into too much about that book because I could talk about it for some time. So non-judging, and how non-judging allows us to touch into that that inner resource that's not always looking into the world for, oh, I like that, I want more of that, that'll make me happy. Oh, I don't want that, I want less of that because that'll make me unhappy. So it's touching with something deep, and just being aware that that's what the minds do. So it's not like throwing your hands up. It's just like it's noticing that that's what is occurring. Acceptance is another attitude, and it's not acceptance is not passive resignation. This is a question maybe one of the most questions, other than the fact that people think. I'm thinking like cocktail party questions. One of people think stopping thoughts is meditation. So I get that one a lot. The other one is this whole acceptance thing. It sounds very passive, like you're going to be a doormat or something, and you're just going to accept life. That's And what about injustice? That's another one I get, especially if it's a party with my more social justice oriented friends. How does this fit in with social justice if you say accepting? And I could give a whole week of talks on this because it's very close to my heart, because I was an angry activist and I slowly became an activist that was more coming from a place of compassion. So that whole process is interesting, and kind of a knowing what acceptance means is very much a part of that. So when I say acceptance, you're accepting the way things are. How could they be any different? Right? So what just happened, I accept it. Because it already happened. So not accepting it is just struggling with reality. But that doesn't mean I accept what some terrible thing that somebody is going to do to me in the future. No, it's not that at all. In fact, by accepting what just happened in the present moment allows the space for a measured response as opposed to a reaction. I hope you follow what I'm saying there. Because sometimes when injustice occurs, it's a reaction. We'll lash out or we'll do something. Whereas if accepting what just happened kind of allows a space for then another response to arise into that space. There's a space between the stimulus and response if we're mindful and aware in the moment. So it's not passive resignation. It's more of an active recognition of the way things are, so that then we can respond wisely. I hope that makes sense. That's like a seven-day talk compressed into a two-minute soundbite. In fact, resistance to the way things are is a major cause of our emotional suffering, because we're fighting against reality itself. We're fighting against what's already just happened. So the best place that transformation begins is from a clear awareness of the situation. And that must include a level of acceptance. The next one is letting go. And letting go simply reminds us to let things be. Not getting caught in the desire for things to be different than they are. Trust is trusting ourselves by listening. Listening to the subtle signals of our body, intuition, you might call it, in each moment. I've taught this mindful leadership course in the government to senior managers, and one thing they really get out of it, or what tends to capture their interest the most, is this notion of intuition, and how I talk about you're missing about, I don't know, I forget the exact number in the research, but it's over half of the information that you can use in making a decision is actually your intuition. I ask, so how many go with their gut? You've heard people say, I go with your gut in these situations. That's actually intuition. There's actually a physiological thing that's going on in your gut that's giving you this intuition, the basal ganglia, if there's any medical people there. It's an actual connection within your body, but it's occurring in the body. So by bringing awareness to that, we can actually tune into this level of intuition. Real quick, there's an interesting study that presented this gambling game to participants. And the way it worked was they had to accumulate points. See if I remember this correctly. And if they turned over, there were red cards and blue cards. And you basically accumulated points by turning over blue cards but not red cards. And it was a little more complicated than that, but we'll just go with that for purposes of the story. And then they turn over these cards, and they had lie detector measures on them, which basically measures body stress, stress in the body. So they would turn over cards, and basically they would be getting these points, and at 20 cards, the body was registering a stress response as they reached for the card that didn't give them points. So the body was basically going, no, 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 not that card. it's because they don't understand. They haven't been told how the game works. So the body's already going in, figuring this out. At 40 cards, the participants reported a gut reaction, a gut feeling that this wasn't the card to turn over, and this was. So they didn't know why, but there was a sort of a gut feeling. Guess how many cards it took before their brain figured it out? Around 100. So they knew, their body knew at 20, if they had been tuned into it enough, the gut reaction might have been known. 40 cards, they knew, and they had a gut feeling, was 100 before cognitively they figured it out. That says a lot about what we can, how valuable a resource just being bodily aware is. Yeah, I mean, all the other aspects of this practice as well. But in terms of how we navigate the world, it's a huge resource. Patience. keep calm under pressure and remind us to enjoy the small moments of life, because life is made up of small moments. So patience is not my strong suit. So that was, I had a teacher that said, he pretty much just said, your patience is a challenge for you, isn't it? I said, yes. And he said, when do you find you're most impatient? I said, lineups at the grocery store drive me crazy. I just get so impatient. I hate it. going home from work, and you got to pick up some groceries, and there's this big lineup, and then just trying to guess which cashier looks like they're having a good day, right? And then which line has the least amount of things in their carts, who looks like they'll get their credit card out the quickest. I try to measure all. That's how impatient I was. I mean, I literally, and then I'd get in the wrong one. Of course, I'd fume at myself. You picked the wrong line. You knew it was that one. You had all the data and you chose this line. And on and on and on, right? You can see the suffering, right? And then, you know, sometimes I would even switch lines. I should still go over there. And then it might be the wrong decision again, right? So this teacher wisely said, well, what I want you to do is on your every day for a month, I want you to go to the grocery store, get a few things off the shelf, and get in the longest line. And just tune into your body. And just the whole experience, but especially the body. What's arising? Thoughts, emotions, moods. Just tune into it all and breathe. Experience impatience. And when you get to the cash, if you actually need the items, you pay for them. But I want every day you to do this. I know, geez, it sounds pretty severe, but I'll try it. And sure enough, after it took a few weeks, but after a while, I really got to know what impatience felt like. It's just a bunch of body sensations and thoughts. It's just this conglomerate of this aggregate of things arising. And if I didn't add layer on the story, it just remained all this conglomerate of stuff arising. And it got after, so I reported this back, and he goes, it's still arising. Yes, yeah, well, another month. Maybe I should have lied and told him it's not arising. So I did another. I ended up doing this for 3 months, and reported that impatience arises sometimes. Sometimes impatience doesn't arise. It really doesn't matter. That, and then I guess that was the correct answer. You can give me another month. So there's this an acceptance of the, and you can do this with anything. Anything you sort of see in your life that is causing you suffering, if you really get to know the landscape of it, it starts to just be something that you can be with, because you're used to being with it. It doesn't have the same juice and trigger that it might have normally had. Non-striving is another attitude, and this is not about having no goals. So we do. It's fine to have a goal in your practice to set. I'm going to meditate every morning or whatever. Or these goals and deep aspirations. It doesn't mean that we're aimless. It's about the ability to then go with the flow. As we move through the practice. Okay. So those are some of the attitudes of mindfulness. You could also add on the positive quality side, things like generosity and gratitude. As also, I think, attitudes to bring to our practice. In terms of how we create suffering for ourselves through our mental habits. I think this is the really strikes at the core of why many people come to this practice. I'll talk about that. And one of my favorite suttas, it's the Two Arrow Sutta, the Salatha Sutta. And it explains what some find confusing in the Dharma. So in the teachings on what is meant to awaken to the Four Noble Truths, the Buddha states that awakening is understanding stress and unhappiness, abandoning the causes of stress and unhappiness, experiencing the cessation of stress and unhappiness, and developing the Eightfold Path leading to the cessation of stress and unhappiness. I'm translating dukkha, the word that's usually translated as suffering, to the word stress and unhappiness. So understanding the First Noble Truth, as I mentioned, means understanding that as a consequence of living in this conditioned phenomenal world, there will be stress and unhappiness. There will be dukkha. That's the part of the way it is. It's part of being alive. We really got to share one of my other favorites. Do I have time? Okay. It's a good one. It's worth taking the time. It's called 83 Problems. There's an old story about a man who came to see the Buddha because he had heard that the Buddha was a great teacher. Like all of us, he had some problems in life, and he thought the Buddha might be able to help him straighten them out. He told the Buddha he was a farmer. "I like farming," he said, "but sometimes it doesn't rain enough and my crops fail. Last year we nearly starved. Sometimes it rains too much, so my yields aren't what I'd like them to be." And the Buddha patiently listened to the man. "And I have kids," said the man. "Good kids too, but sometimes they don't show me enough respect. And sometimes," on and on and on about his kids. The man went on like this, laying out all his difficulties and worries. Finally, he wound down and waited for the Buddha to say the words that would put everything right for him. Instead, the Buddha said, "I can't help you." "What do you mean you can't help me?" said the astonished man. "Everybody's got problems," said the Buddha. "In fact, we've all got 83 problems. Each one of us, 83 problems, and there's nothing you can do about it. If you work really hard on one of them, maybe you can fix it, but if you do, another one will pop right back into its place and you're back at 83 problems. For example, you're going to lose your loved ones eventually, and you're going to die someday. Now there's a problem, and there's nothing you or I or anybody else can do about it." The man became furious. "I thought you were a great teacher," he shouted. "I thought you could help me. What good is your teaching then?" The Buddha said, "Well, maybe it will help. I can help you with your 84th problem." "The 84th problem," said the man. "What the heck is the 84th problem?" The Buddha said, "That you want not to have any problems." That, to me, sums up the First Noble Truth. I mean, that I think was his best, his most direct teaching on the First Noble Truth. Here we all have 83 problems. I'm not sure where 83 come. I'll count them up one day and see what I come up with. See if there's actually 83. So in this Salatha Sutta, the question was put to the Buddha as to what is the distinguishing factor between a well-instructed and well-informed practitioner, meditation, Dharma practitioner, and those that have no understanding of the Four Noble Truths. What is the distinguishing factor? So this is a really deep question. The Buddha responds, "Friends, an ordinary, uninformed person feels feelings of pleasure, feelings of pain, and neutral feelings. One well informed of the Four Noble Truths also feels feelings of pleasure, feelings of pain, and neutral feelings. We all feel the same. When through the sixth sense base an informed person experiences a feeling of pain, they are sorrowful. They grieve, they become distraught and irate. The uninformed feels two pains, the pain of the experience and the pain caused by the reaction arising from clinging. This would be like being hit with an arrow and then by request being hit by a second arrow. As the person is experiencing pain, resistance occurs, leading to resistance obsession. As the person experiences pleasure, delight in pleasure occurs, leading to pleasure obsession. So the first arrow is simply the stress and unhappiness that occurs due to our incarnation in this human body. The second is the stress and unhappiness that's caused by the clinging, the craving for things to be different than they are. And it goes on to say, you know, if you're struck by a second arrow in the same place, the pain is not doubled, it's more like tenfold. So the pain of the reaction is often much more than the pain of the original experience. So that's really, it gets to the core of what we're looking at here. We're not trying to get rid of all our 83 problems. We're looking at how, what are our habitual reactive patterns that's causing us that tenfold increase in stress and unhappiness. And if you can just notice just a little bit of that, it's hugely liberating and freeing. And it's kind of like, you know, like the walking down the street, as you experience more the letting go of and seeing the reaction, either before it even arises or just as it's arising, it becomes a new habit of mind. So it happens at two levels. It becomes a kind of a behavioral habit, and it also actually, and this is newer information, the Buddha didn't have this information, it actually rewires your brain. There's a lot of neurological studies being done showing how it actually changes how our brain is wired. How, you know, the neurons that fire together, wire together. And if you're firing constantly this reactive pattern, then that's what gets, those grooves get worn. Whereas if it's a new pattern, it actually gets strengthened. So awareness becomes more of a default mode than unawareness and therefore reaction. If you're unaware, reaction is really, there's no choice but reaction. Yeah. So second arrow comes in different forms. We can blame others. We can criticize ourselves. We can chase short-term distractions and pleasures, such as stuffing our feelings down with food, retail therapy, work, drugs, whatever it might be. So the Buddha goes on. The well-informed person. So he's talking here about a practitioner, meditation practitioner. When stress arises, has no resistance. With no resistance obsession is formed. With no delight in sensual pleasure, no pleasure obsession occurs. The well-informed person discerns what is actually present and understands its origination, its allure, its drawbacks, and its passing away. He or she remains disjoined from pleasure and pain. This is the distinction between those uninformed and those well informed of the Four Noble Truths. So I just love that sutta. And again, it kind of sums up so well the practice. And it's interesting too how, you know, we're talking how we create extra suffering not only by our relationship to stress and unhappiness, but also how we create suffering with our relationship to the pleasant, the allure of the pleasant. And this one we don't talk about as much, I find, especially in mindfulness circles. We talk more about how suffering occurs in a relationship to the difficulties in our life. But it's really interesting to investigate how suffering occurs in our relationship to the pleasant. I went to Glacier Bay in Alaska, and I looked at, I always wanted to go there, and I looked at pictures, and it's, you know, beautiful pictures that people had taken, and heard people talk about how wonderful it was, and just so I had this image that this was going to be a penultimate experience. The allure of it was, you know, huge, and got there, and yeah. Okay. Yeah, it'd be nice if the sky was blue. It's not. It's kind of cloudy. It's okay, and it was disappointing, right? And there was suffering there. I was in the. It's actually beautiful, but because there's no way reality was ever going to meet the embellishment that I had created in my mind, right? So there had to be suffering. I was setting myself up for suffering, and then of course I realized it after standing there for a while that what had happened. But it really sort of brought home that that aspect of the teaching. I ended up spending 2 months in India at a tantra yoga ashram, where all we did was examine our relationship to the pleasant. So tantra looks specifically at that aspect. I mean, it's known, people think of tantra and they think of the sex, right? But that's a very small part of what tantra is about. Of course, in the West, if there's sex involved in a story, then that's what we talk about. But it's a very small part of the tantric path. But sexual intimacy is one of our pleasurable activities. So, of course, it has to be included in their examination. But we did everything from chocolate cake meditations to, you know, all these, just examining our relationships to all these different, the pleasant in life. And really then being able to enjoy, like, I forget which teacher said, joy is meant to be enjoyed. That's a wonderful way to put it. So we can enjoy. It doesn't mean not enjoying, I guess, works. It's not like we're not enjoying. We're enjoying, but then it's done. It's in the moment. And then it passes. I think the Buddha talks specifically about it. You understand its allure. And it's passing away. It's enjoyed, and then it's gone, and then the next moment's there to enjoy. Yeah. So I want to end on the whole notion of joy and bringing joy into our practice. I think it's so fundamental. Because it can become kind of this... kind of, I don't know if you know what I mean by her, but this kind of tense and struggle, you know, the practice becomes... It's meant to be enjoyed. So enjoy the meditation. Find what is enjoyable of it, and focus on that. Ajahn Sumedho put it, sometimes in Theravada Buddhism, that's the strain of Buddhism that Vipassana Bhavana comes from. One gets the impression that you shouldn't enjoy beauty. If you see a beautiful flower, you should contemplate its decay. Or if you see a beautiful woman, you should contemplate her as a rotting corpse. That's a good reflection on impermanence, dukkha, and selflessness, but it can leave the impression that beauty is not to be reflected on in terms of the three characteristics. So we can delight in joy. And that brings us back to, again, what the Buddha said, and I'll quote him this time. Whatever the practitioner frequently thinks and ponders upon, that will become the inclination of their mind. So although we're building awareness in each moment and awareness of our difficulties, we also really bring awareness to the joys that arise spontaneously, like revel in them. So if you have that momentary sense of connectedness with somebody or beauty in the forest, just stop and dwell in it. Dwell in that joy and really feel what that joy feels like. And that will become the inclination of your mind. I went through a phase where I was, you know, if there was a gun in a show, I wouldn't watch the show anymore because I didn't want my mind to be inclined towards anything other than joy. Took it a bit far, but I'm a bit, you know, that way. I've mellowed a little on that. But that, you know, that was a practice that I had set my intention to only plant seeds that were loving, caring, joyous, and to avoid planting any seeds of hatred and violence and greed and so forth. As a practice. So that's the media that we consume, the news. You can't watch the news anymore if that's a practice. It really becomes the reality because it does plant seeds of joy for the most part. The Sutta Nipata says, all the delightful things of the world, sweet sounds, lovely forms, all the pleasant tastes and touches and thoughts, these are all agreed to bring happiness if they are not grasped and possessed. Want me to read that one again? Mm-hmm. All the delightful things of the world, sweet sounds, lovely forms, all the pleasant tastes and touches and thoughts, these are all agreed to bring happiness if they are not grasped and possessed. But if you regard them merely as pleasures for your own use and satisfaction, and do not see them as passing wonders, they will bring suffering. I'll leave one more quote and then we'll sit for a few minutes. A quote from the Buddha in the Dhammapada. Live in joy, in love, even among those who hate. Live in joy, in health, even among the afflicted. Live in joy, in peace, even among the troubled. Look within, be still. Free from fear and attachment, know the sweet joy of living in the way. Know the sweet joy of living in the way. So we'll sit for what's the schedule? Yeah. We'll sit, and then we have
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.